Good day to you. It's the first day of spring eve, and it feels like it outside, doesn't it? At least someplace in the world, not here. You've dialed up the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule for this Tuesday, March 19th. I'm Phil Picardi. Coming up, to pay or not to pay back the school age shift. It's illegal to drive without a driver's license in the state, but a requirement to be legal to get a license may go by the wayside soon. Some schools are concerned about a statewide anti-bullying bill. Some Twin Cities bar patrons will be playing electronic bingo this week. Is Rochester ready for growth? And Michelle Bachmann, will she or won't she? First, Democrats in the Minnesota House have released their list of spending priorities, and Tom Scheck says many are struggling to keep a campaign promise to pay off an existing debt to schools. That promise helped Democrats take control of the legislature, but Governor Mark Dayton says he doesn't want to pay it back immediately.
Governor Dayton says his budget plan would increase state education spending by $640 million over the next 2 years. The money would go to early childhood education, K-12 schools, and higher education. One thing Dayton's budget plan does not do is fully pay back what's left of a $2.4 billion K-12 payment delay that was used earlier to help balance the state budget. The accounting shift now stands at about $800 million because some money was paid back due to increased tax collections. Dayton says he doesn't see the need to pay back the rest of the past debt immediately because there's a mechanism in the law to pay it back if the budget shows a surplus.
We're on a timely repayment schedule, and you know, to take $800 million now out of everything else and put that into repaying the schools, I think is unsound fiscal policy and unnecessary given the pace at which we're repaying the debt.
Democrats in the House are taking a different view. DFL Representative Paul Marquardt of Dilworth, who chairs the House K-12 Finance Committee, says Democrats campaigned on paying back the school shift, and he says they also plan to increase funding for education.
We can do both. As I said from the onset, not only can we pay back the school shifts, which we should, and living up to our commitments, but invest in creating a path to get our kids to the world's best workforce.
But even House Democrats don't appear to be poised to pay back the entire school shift. Marquardt would only commit to paying back roughly $260 million. He hedged when asked about the other $550 million in shifted payments that he notes is not directly tied to students in the classroom. Senate Democrats are set to release their spending priorities on Wednesday. DFL Senator Chuck Wieger of Maplewood said he doesn't see the need to pay back the school shift right away. He said doing so would mean less money for all-day kindergarten, special education funding, and early childhood education.
If you put $250 million into the shift, you're going to have a corresponding reduction in your flexibility to invest in additional programs.
House Republicans have been working to make the K-12 payment delay an issue this session. Republican Representative Kelby Woodard of Belle Plaine says Democrats are scrambling to find a way to meet the campaign promise of paying back the school shift and increasing total funding for schools.
There's no doubt they've made a lot of promises to people on spending more money. And, paying back the old bills, paying back the credit card bill, is not as fun as giving people additional projects and programs they're looking for. We got to pay back that credit card bill first. That's the prudent thing to do.
Woodard didn't offer specifics on how Republicans can erase the deficit and pay back the school shift without raising taxes. Education groups say they'd prefer to see lawmakers not pay back the shift right away. Scott Kroonquist, with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, says districts would prefer to see lawmakers direct more money to schools instead of paying back the shift.
Any available dollars they have, they need to direct to programs or funding streams that are actually going to provide new money to schools. And the reality is that paying the shift back doesn't provide one penny to school districts. It's just paying them what they already have coming sooner.
But increasing funding for schools will also increase the amount the state will eventually owe the schools. State finance officials say the shift would increase from $800 million to $1.2 billion if Governor Dayton's increase in school funding is enacted.
Tom Scheck at the state capitol. Bills to loosen the driver's license restrictions aimed at illegal immigrants are moving through the state legislature. Sasha Aslanian says a proposal passed by a state Senate panel yesterday reverses rules made during the Pawlenty administration.
The Senate Transportation Committee was packed with supporters of the bill, many with small children in tow. The bill would allow identification issued by another country to be acceptable proof of identity when applying for a Minnesota driver's license. Democrats say the bill would improve public safety because right now, unlicensed drivers don't take behind-the-wheel or written exams, and they're not insured. Wendy Hickey testified about her husband's experience. Hickey's husband crossed the border from Mexico and arrived in Minnesota in 1996.
My husband had a Minnesota driver's license for 14 years. Approximately 3 years ago, he received a letter in the mail stating his license was canceled, but if he were to show proof of residency in this country, he would be able to get it back. My husband is not able, due to the current immigration laws, to have legal status at this time.
Hickey told senators her husband lost his livelihood once he couldn't drive and can't provide transportation for the couple's three young children, who are all U.S. citizens. Several Democrats said the bill was about driver's licenses and not an immigration bill. But Republicans raised questions about allowing immigrants without legal residence to obtain state IDs. Senator Dave Osmek, a Republican from Mound, warned that driver's licenses are also used to register to vote and show proof of identification on the job.
It also goes for going through something as simple as airport security. The driver's license is just not exclusively, myopically, just for driving in Minnesota. It is for a number of residency establishment clauses in our statutory language and in what we do here in Minnesota, and that's the issue.
The bill passed the Senate Transportation Committee along party lines. A similar bill passed a House committee last week. Currently, four states, Illinois, New Mexico, Utah, and Washington, allow unauthorized immigrants to drive.
That's Sasha Aslanian. Minnesota lawmakers are considering beefing up the state's anti-bullying law. And while school administrators applaud the effort, there is concern over cost. Tim Post says the proposal would replace Minnesota's current anti-bullying law, which at 37 words is considered one of the weakest in the nation.
DFL Senator Scott Dibble's version of the Safe and Supportive Minnesota Schools Act essentially scraps the state's current law and replaces it with a much more detailed and many would say stronger measure. Dibble from Minneapolis presented his bill at a recent Senate Education Committee hearing.
Madam Chair and members, we've waited too long to address bullying that occurs in our schools and across our state.
The state's current anti-bullying law simply mandates schools have a bullying policy in place, but doesn't offer advice on what should be in that policy. In a 2011 investigation, Minnesota Public Radio News found the state's weak bullying law resulted in inconsistent policies at schools across the state. Many students, parents, educators, and experts say that's put Minnesota kids at greater risk of being targeted by bullies. The proposed new law would mandate all public, charter, and private schools put a stronger policy in place. It would also require schools to create anti-bullying programs, train all employees on how to handle bullying, and better document and investigate any incidents of bullying. Senator Dibble says revamping the state's bullying law is the best way to protect students.
Every kid can come to school and know that they have a place at that school, that they're valued for who they are, that they can be free from the distraction that bullying represents.
No one is sure how much it will cost schools to implement the changes in the proposed law. And at this point, neither the House nor the Senate version of the bill includes any funding. That has Kelly Smith, the superintendent of the Belle Plaine School District, a bit worried.
We struggle to find dollars to fill the needs that we have within the district, and this may be one more thing that we have to fit into that budget.
Smith isn't opposed to the bill and thinks there needs to be improvements to bullying policies across the state, but he's concerned he'll need to hire additional personnel to handle an increase in paperwork tied to bullying programs and investigations. And he's wondering where he'll find room in his budget to pay for extra training days for teachers and staff. When New Jersey put a new bullying law in place 2 years ago, one very similar to Minnesota's proposed law, it didn't include funding. New Jersey schools cried unfunded mandate. A state panel agreed, and lawmakers ended up offering schools $1 million to train staff on how to handle bullying. Senator Scott Dibble says his bill does call for the development of a grant program at the State Department of Education.
And this would allow schools to apply to the Commissioner of Education for grants for the programs that they might want to bring into their schools to address bullying.
Dibble is hopeful the bullying bill will get funding as it moves through the legislative process. Superintendent Kelly Smith says if funding is allocated for bullying programs, he wants it to go straight to schools rather than through a grant program.
We don't have a grant writer, so who's that work going to go to? So the district with the best grant writer is going to get that money and better serve their students.
In his budget proposal this session, Governor Dayton is asking lawmakers for $1 million to fund a new school climate center. The governor says it would offer advice and training to schools on anti-bullying efforts.
Education reporter Tim Post on the NPR News Update. Electronic bingo will soon be joining electronic pull tabs in bars around the state as Minnesota tries to reboot charitable gambling and pay off a Viking stadium. Backers hope the games with bigger jackpots will jumpstart electronic gambling. Tim Nelson told Tom Cran about eBingo on All Things Considered last night.
Let's start with the basics. What exactly is electronic linked bingo, and how is it different from old-fashioned bingo a lot of us might remember?
Well, it works the same way with a computer calling random numbers. Players keep track of what's being called on what looks like a bingo card that's displayed on a wireless tablet, like an iPad.
All right.
The linked part is the real difference here. Players in bars from Laverne to International Falls could all be playing the same game with the same balls over a secure internet connection. That means the games could be going on all the time, and the prizes, because so many people are playing, could get very large, into four or five figures.
Now, how does that compare to usual bingo prizes now?
Well, because of tax laws and other regulations, charitable gambling prizes, like pull tabs, for instance, are limited to $1,499. So we're talking 50 times bigger for a single ticket, or bingo card in this case. That's why backers have been so excited about this. They think when word gets out about these really big jackpots, people will come flocking to the games in a way that they haven't been to electronic pull tabs. They also think that the bingo games will be easier to share. Like, you know, say when a softball team comes in after a game, they go into a bar and chip in for $100 worth of pull tabs and they all open them together. I talked to Jim Wellborn. He's the operations and marketing manager for ETAB Manufacturing. He's the company that makes this first electronic bingo game.
We think there's going to be a demand for the device. So you could get five people together and go, let's buy 36 cards on a one device. And we'll put it in the table and you can see the balls as they're being called. And we think that'll be much more social than the electronic pull tabs, which is more of an individual thing.
And, you know, they're counting on this, that there'll be this big hubbub and lots of word of mouth about these games that you don't get, for instance, you know, when you buy a scratch-off lottery ticket at a gas station.
Now, we've talked a lot in the past about the electronic pull tabs, Tim, and how they aren't measuring up to projections here. So why would this electronic bingo work any differently?
Well, we don't know. In fact, this manufacturer with this same device playing pull tabs has been a particular disappointment on that pull tab side. Now, pull tabs were supposed to be in 2,500 bars last fall, and they weren't even in one-tenth of that number back in February. That's the most recent data we have. These bingo games are supposed to be in about half of those pull tab sites, so it's already got a headwind here because there aren't as many established locations to piggyback on. And while they aren't as big as pull tabs, there are some big numbers here. The state was counting on about 7,000 of these electronic link bingo machines being out there, each one taking in about $100 of bets a day.
Well, now what happens if this doesn't work?
Well, all the backup plans so far include more gambling. Right now, the most likely fallback being weighed by the state is to launch a state lottery game dedicated to the stadium, which is already authorized in the stadium law. Now, the state lottery has had Vikings and Twins scratch-off games, but lottery officials say they could help the stadium with even a new Powerball-like game or even Keno. That's like a mini lottery based in a bar. Now, that has charities and pull tab makers worried because that could put these small-time operators like veterans clubs and youth hockey associations directly in competition with the state lottery, which could make it even tougher for electronic games that aren't doing well. But the crunch time comes later this summer now. The state hasn't actually borrowed any money for the new stadium. They won't do that till about August. And they said they'll probably have to make a decision this summer if they have to go to a plan B to make the mortgage payments.
Tim Nelson, thank you for an update on electronic bingo. There's a lot more about stadium funding from Tim on our blog, Stadium Watch at nprnews.org. Thanks, Tim.
You're welcome.
Tim Nelson tracks stadium funding for NPR News. He talked with Tom Cran. The state's fastest growing city is Rochester. City leaders have spent years planning how and where to grow. Now Rochester's flagship employer, the Mayo Clinic, is asking for state help to pay for roads, bridges, and sewers as part of its plan to become an even bigger global medical hub. Here's Elizabeth Baer.
On the very edge of northwest Rochester, where parts of the road are still unpaved and bumpy, city planner Phil Wheeler points to the physical transformation that's underway.
To our right is an urban development with 6,000 square foot lots and single family homes. To our west is, looks like soybean field maybe, based on the absence of stubble.
Wheeler says Rochester will need more of these lots if Mayo intends to grow in the coming decades. With about 107,000 residents, Rochester is already the state's third largest city. Officials here have made their own population forecast, one that estimates about 32,000 additional residents in the next two decades. Wheeler says these forecasts rely on state funding to help create Mayo's Destination Medical Center, or DMC, which could add up to 15,000 highly paid medical positions and another 25,000 spin-off jobs in southeastern Minnesota in the next two decades.
We assumed that Rochester and Olmsted County would maintain the competitive edge that our health sector and our other information sectors have had. That implies that something like the DMC will have to be done, because you don't maintain a competitive edge by coasting.
2 decades ago, most of northwest Rochester was farmland. Then the housing developments came, and in typical growth pattern, next came the churches and a hospital. Now, strip malls and big box stores dot the neighborhood. Since 2000, Rochester's had 179 separate annexations and added 9,500 acres to its city limits. Northwest Rochester has accounted for more than half of that growth. Wheeler says this low-density development of mostly single-family homes is putting a fiscal strain on the city.
We should be putting a lot more into our capital improvements program to reconstruct roads in order to do it at the lowest life cycle cost. We're way under that. We have a backlog of things to make up for, too. We annexed areas without curb and gutter, without sidewalks and so on. So we have this area that needs to be brought up to an urban standard in order to handle the urban density of development that will occur there.
Rochester will need $2.4 billion to pave roads, add sidewalks, and handle other transportation needs in the next 25 years. But based on current revenue sources and competing needs like operations and maintenance, officials anticipate a gap of hundreds of millions of dollars. Professor Ed Goetz, who directs the Center for Urban and Regional Affairs at the University of Minnesota, says this is a common problem for mid-sized cities like Rochester.
For many years, local officials sort of went under the assumption that growth pays for itself, in the sense that, you know, the attraction of business and then the attraction of more residents will enhance the tax base, and that will pay for the types of services and amenities that is necessary. But there's probably been some growing acknowledgement that that's not always the case.
Mayo wants to invest $3 billion of its own money to become an even bigger global medical hub. And it's asking the state to pitch in with $500 million to help pay for infrastructure needs associated with that growth. But Goetz says the proposal requires a greater sell job because Mayo is the driving force behind the request.
This is usually something that cities will think about in kind of a generic sense. That is, they want to attract businesses of certain types, and they will set up these kinds of tax incentives. For an employer to sort of come out front and argue for this, I haven't seen that happen anywhere else.
Based on Rochester's growth projections, officials with Rochester Public Utility are also evaluating how to keep up with the growing demand for water and power. The utility company is in the process of replacing a water reservoir to meet future water demands of the downtown area. The project is expected to cost several million dollars and be complete in 2014. Local utilities are also working with the U.S. Geological Survey to study groundwater flow and pumping rates from Rochester's water source, the Jordan Aquifer. And businesses are also reimagining themselves as they look north and west to expand in Rochester's growth bubble. Last year, Barbara Height Randall and her husband moved their jewelry business of nearly two decades to the outskirts of town to be closer to their customers.
Things were changing downtown, and I know that downtown development doesn't like to hear this, but parking was an issue for us. We have seniors who come to our store, and not being able to park was just a difficulty.
Even with the concentration of people downtown because of the Mayo Clinic, Height Randall says they're better off in an outer neighborhood.
The amount of building is just growing by leaps and bounds, and we're hearing about new businesses all the time. So we seem to be leading the parade a bit, which can be a little scary and a little challenging, but it's going to be, you won't even recognize it.
Perhaps Height Randall is right. Unlike other Minnesota cities, Rochester hasn't stopped growing. And if growth projections stay on target, perhaps in 20 years, her jewelry store will no longer be on the outskirts of the city.
Elizabeth Baer there in Rochester. A proposed high-speed rail line between Duluth and the Twin Cities has inched a step closer to possible construction. Dan Crocker has the details.
The Federal Railroad Administration has released the environmental assessment for the proposed Northern Lights Express. It's now open for public comment for a month. The rail line would cost an estimated $700 million to build for trains capable of 110 miles per hour. Bob Manzoline, executive director of the St. Louis and Lake Counties Regional Rail Authority, says completing the environmental study is a big milestone.
It allows us to then proceed with, if everything's approved, proceed with designing the project.
Next steps include the preliminary engineering, a two-year process that's already been allocated $8 million in state and federal dollars. The project is a partnership between several cities and counties along the route, but last summer, Anoka County pulled out. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
Six moose the DNR collared earlier this winter in northeastern Minnesota as part of a study to determine what's causing their rapid decline have already died. Four died within 2 weeks after they were captured. DNR wildlife veterinarian Erica Butler says the stress of being chased down and drugged to have the collar applied can sometimes lead to what researchers call capture-related mortality.
So we did lose four that way, and that's not unusual. That's a pretty expected rate of mortalities, especially when we're dealing with an unhealthy population of moose like we are.
Butler says wolves killed the other two near Grand Marais. She says it's too early to draw conclusions from those deaths, but says this time of year researchers expect to see wolf kills. The DNR collared 111 moose for this study. The moose population in northeastern Minnesota has dropped 35% from last year and more than 50% since 2010. Finally, to close out the podcast, a look at Republican Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann. She held a news conference to call for more transportation spending in her district yesterday. Mark Zedeklik says she hasn't said if she will run for re-election or a higher office.
Bachmann gathered local and state officials as well as people from six congressional district area businesses to call for hundreds of millions of dollars in funding to add lanes to Interstate 94 and upgrade Highway 10. Introducing herself to the room of people who knew who she was, Bachmann tripped over her words in a way that highlighted a political problem she's working to overcome.
My name is Michelle Bachmann. I'm the member of Congress who's fortunate enough to represent the good people in Minnesota's 6th Congressional District.
Bachmann narrowly won re-election last fall, defeating DFL newcomer Jim Graves by a little more than one percentage point. Critics complained that Bachmann's presidential campaign came at the expense of remembering and representing her 6th District constituents. Rothenberg Political Report senior analyst Jessica Taylor says as a Republican running in the state's most conservative district, Bachmann should have easily won. Bachmann is not saying whether she plans to run for re-election to Congress again next year, but Taylor notes that Bachmann has largely been absent from the national stage.
The steps that she seems to be taking right now
to sort of repair her image locally. Seems to suggest that she's running for re-election to her congressional district. Again, we'll see. But you know, for right now, that seems like what she is focused on. You know, we haven't seen a lot of her on Fox News or national television shows.
Bachman denies that she's conducting her congressional business in a different way than previous terms. But she emphasizes that she held some 300 local meetings this year alone in an effort to get a handle on what the people she represents in Congress are concerned about.
And 300 meetings is a lot of meetings. And so I've been very intentional. I tried to sit down with every state senator, every state rep, every mayor, county commissioners. You go down the line, the sheriffs, because I wanted to know what the pulse was.
I think what you're seeing now is a dramatic change in the political perspective of Michelle Bachman.
Carleton College political science professor Stephen Scheer says he too thinks Bachman is positioning herself for another congressional re-election campaign next year. Scheer says it's unclear whether Bachman can repair the damage from paying so much attention to national politics.
The worst situation for a congressional incumbent is to be known in your district and not be popular. And I think that's one of the problems Michelle Bachman now faces. People have made up their minds in their district about her.
Scheer dismisses speculation Bachman would attempt a run for U.S. Senate or governor after barely winning in her own district. Democrats are almost certain to make Bachman a top target if she runs again next year. But Jessica Taylor from the Rothenberg Political Report says Bachman's prospects should be stronger in 2014 than they were in 2012, if for no other reason than it's an off year. Democrats typically do well in Minnesota in presidential election years. Even if Jim Graves runs and attracts a lot of national money, Taylor says 2014 could be an altogether different year for him than 2012.
But I think it becomes even more difficult for him in a midterm year where you aren't going to see the surge probably in Democratic turnout in a state like Minnesota. And so I think you could see a more Republican electorate, especially there in the 6th District.
The tone of Bachman's fundraising materials suggests she's planning to run again. But she's sidestepping re-election questions and says she's focused on other things right now.
Well, I'll be announcing, I suppose, at some point, but it's a little early for that.
Pressed about a timeline for a possible re-election announcement, Bachman said probably not before the crocuses come. Jim Graves says he's giving very serious consideration to running again and that he will make an announcement in very early April.
Z-Man on the podcast on 319. 319, 319, Seth Hutt. I'm Phil Picardi. Thanks for your company. More Minnesota news on your schedule right here tomorrow.